This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Since the birth of the nation, we have turned to stories about the American South to narrate the rapid ascendancy of the United States on the world stage. This idea of a cohesive South, different from, yet integral to, the United States, came about with the very formation of the nation itself. A semi-tropical climate, plantation production, heterogeneous population, it once defined the New World from the perspective of Europe. By founding U.S. literature through opposition to the South, writers boldly asserted their nation to stand apart from the imperial world order. The new book is Our South: Geographic Fantasy and the Rise of National Literature. It's an honor to welcome to the program for the first time Jennifer Greeson from the University of Virginia's School of English. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess my first question for you is, would Thomas Jefferson have considered himself a Southerner? Was there this idea at the time of this regional identity in the 18th century and early 19th century of a South?
Yeah, so this is really the starting point of my book in many ways. It's always good to start from Jefferson.
Right? Yeah, of course. you're at UVA,
I'm at
for
UVA
goodness.
Now, yes. but this is really the starting point of my book. I think it's absolutely the case that Thomas Jefferson would not have considered himself to be a Southerner. I hope all your experts would agree with me. I think they would. He understood himself to be a Virginian. At the moment of the Revolution, he understood himself to be an American. But the idea that there was a South that would mean that he had, as a Virginian, some sort of special alliance with the other states south of the Mason-Dixon line, that was just something that was not part of his mental landscape whatsoever. I mean, he had no sort of close feeling of brotherhood with the state of South Carolina that he didn't have with the state of Massachusetts or anything like that.
Interesting.
So he referred
to his country. My country is Virginia, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, and I mean, with his you know, one published book from his lifetime, The Notes on the State of Virginia, he really posits Virginia itself as a characterization of the whole United States. You know, it's not a sort of a part of it or a faction of it. It literally, you could know the whole United States by just knowing Virginia.
We're talking with Jennifer Greeson of the University of Virginia. And once upon a time, as the saying goes, all of America was indeed Virginia. We called the South, went by the name America. This one colony, Virginia, was huge, of course. It was all of English America. And the South, it was the Midwest, it was everything below a certain line. So that's, I guess, one place to begin as well, is this idea that once upon a time, all of America was Virginia.
Yes, I think that's a great place to begin. And Jefferson is very clear about that in the Notes on the State of Virginia, which he is writing during that, you know, scary governor period,
right?
Whenever
right.
he sort of has to run away from the state house for a little while during the Revolutionary War. And so instead he's writing a book, and he's very clear, you know, that Virginia was originally the continent of North America. And so the first query in Notes on the State of Virginia are, what are the boundaries of the state? And he says, well, let me tell you,
yeah.
you know, originally it was essentially without boundaries. And then he goes through a sequence of historical partitionings that the people of Virginia have consented to in certain ways
yeah.
in order to get the state down to its current size in the 1780s. So yes, I mean, there's a way in which, this is part of how he presents Virginia as being representative of everything that's going on in America, in English America, in the United States that's emerging at the moment of the Revolution. One of the things that then happens that I think is really interesting, and this is really the starting point of the book, is that at that moment of the Revolution, people who are trying to explain what America is now that it's not this ragtag collection of 13 British colonies anymore, they have to get rid of those old definitions of what America is, right? The America that's defined from the perspective of Europe, especially from the perspective of England. So this old idea that all of, you know, North America is Virginia, there's also a very important idea that all of English, North American colonization is plantation, right? So if you, you know, the name of the state of Rhode Island is Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. That's its, still its official name. They're talking about finally changing that. Or if you've ever gone to see, you know, the Plymouth Rock settlement, it's called Plymouth Plantation.
Yeah. This was a British idea.
This was the British idea.
Their conceptualization of what it looked like and what it was and how they described it.
It's a settler colony. It's a planting of people and it's a planting of the soil. And it's in contradistinction to Spanish colonization, which is seen as an extractive colonization. It's about mining, looking for gold, sending soldiers, extracting wealth, and heading back to Europe. The British are doing something that they see as being morally superior. It's about civilizing the land. And that's plantation. So you have these sort of baselines of British-American colonialism that U.S. writers need to reject in certain kinds of ways to explain that the United States is something new. So it's not a plantation, right? It's not Jamaica anymore. It's not the rest of North. It's not Canada, right? It's not plantation-based. It's not Virginia. It's not tropical, right? That's another important sort of marker that's hooked to America. But then really, and you can understand why writers want to get rid of those old associations. The interesting thing that happens is that they keep them for these states to the south of the Mason-Dixon line for whatever reason. And so that at the moment that writers, and I'm talking about writers of literature, not politicians.
Yeah.
At the moment that writers of literature start to create this imaginative idea of what this new country is, they think about there being this sort of South that's held apart from it that looks very much not new. It looks old. It looks like colonial British America in certain kinds of ways. And I find this to be completely fascinating. That this South that looks like old colonial British America, you know, this is nowhere in the political discourse of the day. It's not in the political debates. People are not talking about this when they're writing the Constitution, for instance.
They're not in the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. You're talking about the South. Or the Southern colonies.
Right.
Doesn't exist. Yeah.
No, it really largely doesn't. People have looked very hard for it. And so people can find individual quotes. But no, it's not a widely accepted
That regional
idea.
Identity does not exist
no,
yet.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. Yet, in novels, in stories, in imaginative literature, it's really taking hold. So it's something that's only perceivable in the 1780s, say, in the 1790s, from outside of the southern states.
We're talking with Jennifer Greeson. Her new book is Our South, Geographic Fantasy and the Rise of National Literature. So this idea of a regional South is born at the time of the American Revolution as a way to describe the southern colonies. But the description doesn't come from the South. It comes from out of fiction, out of novels, out of U.S. writers in the North.
Yeah, I mean that's in the North. I try not to use the term in the North because I mean I think we're so cued to thinking about the South as emerging with sort of sectionalist politics that lead up to the Civil War.
Yeah.
And so where there is a South, there must be a North, you know, that counterbalances it. But what I'm really looking at is the United States and its South, right? And those are sort of the two terms. So it's not exactly a binary, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But so, yes, I mean, this, and I think that this has to do, this sort of weirdness of early literature has to do with how literature gets produced, right? So there are printing presses all over the colonies. There are printing presses widely dispersed everywhere. They're printing things like broadsides and newspapers,
yeah.
Right? Every little town has its own newspaper. But literature is something that tends to be produced in a very limited sort of geographical scope at the center. It's something that happens at the cultural capital. So all the novels that are published before 1800 in the U.S., for instance, and all the literary magazines are published between Philadelphia and Boston in that little eastern seaboard corridor. And mostly they're published in Boston, New York and Philadelphia. Since that's where literature gets produced, it does kind of make sense to me that it's easier for people to think about a South that would seem monolithic, that would seem, you know, to be inhabited by palm trees, you know, yeah. or whatever.
And then so they create then in the writing here in these northern, what we would think of now as these northern cities.
Yeah, in the cities.
They create this sort of fancified imaginary idea of this regional place that they call the South.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the South is born in the North, I mean, to be blunt about it.
Well, I mean, right. So one of the things that I think maybe is a little disappointing to people whenever they pick up my book is they want it to be about Southern literature per se.
Yeah.
You know, that the way that we define that since the great sort of movements in Southern writing in the 20th century is we define it as literature that comes out of the Southeastern states, right? But I'm really, yes, I'm absolutely looking at literature that does not come out
yeah.
of the Southeastern states.
Well, you're really writing the prelude and the backstory
yes, right.
to Faulkner. I mean, what happened before the agrarians and how did this whole idea of the South as a place, how was that created?
Right. And even before sectionalist politics. So that at the time that politicians start taking up the banner of oh, yes, we are the South, which they take up, you know, to horrible ends. But at the moment that they do that, it's something that already exists as an imaginative category because of the novels that people were reading.
Jennifer Greeson is with the University of Virginia's Department of English. Her new book is Our South. Honored to have her live in studio. It's 5:20. So the idea of the South is born in these novels that come out of, you know, Philadelphia and New York and Boston in the last quarter of the 18th century. Was the South created as this idealized place, or did they sort of treat it the way people in Appalachia were treated, for example, in the 20th century, sort of poking fun at their Southern neighbors to the South, or was it both?
It wasn't so much a matter of fun as a general rule. It wasn't usually a comic topic, not until you get further into the 19th century. I think it was something that caused people actually a lot more discomfort than that. It wasn't a laughing matter usually. And, you know, one of the questions that I had to ask myself as I was finding this permeation of the early period in the literary magazines, the novels, with the South that keeps coming up. One of the things I had to ask myself was, what is this good for? You know, why do people need to populate their imagined landscape of this new United States with this South? And one of the things that I think that it was very good for was for essentially creating what we would now call American exceptionalism. But the idea that the United States sort of emerges out of the Revolution fully formed, brand new. It has no past, right? It has no precedent in human history.
And there's something very uniquely special about it.
Of course.
Yeah. From day one.
It's sort of perfected. It's always sort of on the right side of history. This is great, right? It's innocent, you know, not fallen. And it's the Republic, right? It's a nation that, as has never happened before in human history, is going to be based on freedom, on consensual, consent to government, not on relations of domination and submission, right?
Yeah.
No king, no subjects, no masters, no slaves, right? No colony, no empire. The thing that the South does is that it's sort of the anti-republic, right? It's the opposite. So when the South comes into literature, it's not new. It's absolutely old. It's absolutely familiar. It is the old colonial plantation of British New World colonization. It's defined by its guilt in a certain kind of way. It's defined by its past.
And that helps those northern writers and what we would call the northern writers then really to define the new America.
Right.
And the South is sort of the straw man that they set up and say, this is symbolic of the old world, of the
right.
of old England,
right.
of Mother England, and we're not that.
Look how different it is when you cross the Mason-Dixon, right? When you cross over into Maryland, you find yourself in a different world, you know, is this common locution. When I entered into one of the states to the southward of Philadelphia, you know, the complexion of everything changed. This is incredibly common. Now, what is, you know, then another question that I had is, well, why keep it in the United States? Why not say, when I took a boat over to Jamaica, this is how it looked. Or when I went into Spanish Florida, this is how it looked. But the wonderful thing that the South does, and that's really sort of why the book is called Our South, is that it lets writers sort of acknowledge and work through, you know, the fact that the nation wasn't new and that it came with a lot of baggage and that, you know, British colonials have been living in the United States for a long time, not guilt-free. You know, they'd fought Native peoples for the land. The United States was constituted as a slave-holding republic. I mean, the United States wasn't sort of born free in a certain way. By writing about the South, this is the wonderful thing about literature and literary imagination, too. You get to sort of have it both ways. It's inside and outside. You know, look, we can actually spatially journey into our dark past, you know, by getting on the stagecoach and going from Philadelphia to Baltimore, right? We can revisit, you know, those demons that we disavow. But then we can come back north and we can say, that's just how those people are down there, right? It's our South, but it's different from us, right?
These ideas then that were created in literature in the 18th century, they gradually found their way into political rhetoric, and were politicized. And did they contribute then to, you know, many decades later to this sectionalism, this idea, and eventually revolution, and the Southerners objecting then to these Northern ideas?
I mean, that's a great question. I don't know that I can. That I would be, you know, I'm not qualified to to diagnose the causes of the Civil War or anything like that.
Like a true professor.
I try to steer away from that. Well, I am in the English department.
Yeah,
we don't do these things. But certainly, I mean, certainly a nation's literature sets the horizons of possibility for its people, right? I mean, that is in reading a novel, I think in particular, but reading an epic poem, or, you know, we sort of, how do we understand where we stand on the face of the earth? How do we understand what it means to be an American and what kinds of relations that implies, you know, inside the nation with other people and with peoples outside of the nation, right? A lot of that gets mapped out in compelling ways in the sort of fantasy life of literature. And so I think that there are ways that literature sets sort of the horizons of possibility for how people are able to think through things like fighting over the tariff or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's
sure.
Significant then that this actually, the very beginnings of this project in American literature involved the South. And it was important to include that for various reasons, from the very, very beginning.
Right, even though, you know, the literature wasn't being produced out of those Southern states. And once the literature does start being produced by writers who are sort of more self-identifying with the Southern states, there's already a sort of paradigm that they have to fit into or they have to deal with. There's a South that predates them in some kind of way.
So that by the time the Agrarians and Faulkner come into being in the early 20th century, the turn of the 20th century, there's already baggage. There's already a stage that's been set for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost old news. I mean, Poe is sort of running around yelling about the New England hegemony in American letters, you know, 100 years before the Agrarians. Well, I'm exaggerating, 80 years before. So, those conflicts are there. Mm-hmm.
Jennifer Greeson, her new book is Our South, Geographic Fantasy and the Rise of National Literature. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.